We got a real simple plan. One me and one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven. This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day Podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel, here's Reese Davis.
The Final Four is set. What it has that is most compelling and the one thing that it will lack. From heartbreak to hiring a new head coach, Texas makes a move after the devastating loss to Miami, and tournament DNA. Does it matter? Why? This is the College Game Day Podcast for Monday, March 27th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel back together again. Pete was in Louisville and saw the final of the South Region, the championship game between regional final between Creighton and San Diego State. So I think before we get into this Final Four, which I think is different simply because it's the first one since 1970 with three newcomers in it that have no Final Four experience. You've got a blue blood in it. I don't care what anybody says. UConn is a blue blood, regardless of what's happened the last few years. But that game that you saw yesterday between Creighton and San Diego State, not aesthetically pleasing, but certainly dramatic at the end. What were your thoughts about the foul call at the end? And then you have some stuff in the aftermath. But to me, Pete, that's a foul. I complain about no offense all the time. And if you're going to let all the other junk go, and I understand there was stuff that should have been called earlier in the game that wasn't, and then they call this. You start with protecting shooters. You start with protecting shooters. It was a foul. It just was. And, you know, and I was glad they called it.
I had a pretty simple take on that. It was a foul. And it was right in front of me when it happened. And, you know, I think it might have been called a beat late. And it may have occurred a little later within the shot process than people would have liked. But it was a difficult call. But I think it was absolutely the right call. Now, there's an argument, and a lot of people made it, that you can't call the game as loose as they did. And they called that game loose. There were like three or four times where I was just like, whoa, you know, they let them play.
Well, it was a San Diego State game. So that's going to happen. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They are. Boy, did they slog through Louisville, man. Woo!
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah.
they are a bunch of beautiful, artless grunts. then they have Darren Trammell.
But winners.
Yeah.
But
so,
winners.
No. They're good. Yeah. Yeah. And look, like, I think Brian Dutcher, to defend them, says to guys, you will not come here if you don't totally and wholly commit to playing defense. And that is their backbone. That is their DNA. And then they had some, you know, occasional moments of good offense. But at the end of the day, Ryan Nembhard got beat off the dribble. Cleanly and clearly beat off the dribble on that play. And he was playing catch up. As someone who's gotten beaten off the dribble a lot in his life, like, I can relate to this. All right. So what do you do when you're clearly beaten off the dribble? You put your hand on the guy's hip to try to alter his shot. And there was actually a great tweet. Al Toby, one of my old editors at Yahoo, put it out. He did the Super Bowl grab. Mm-hmm. And then he did that. And he actually never had a tug of jersey along with the push on Darren. So now, was it a little dramatic how he fell after? Yeah, absolutely. You know, but at the core, I agree with you completely that was a foul. It was the right call. I think the officials thought about it for a second because they knew the stakes, and then Lee Castle made the call. And I think you have to make that there. You can't have that guy, you know, roll down the lane like that. And if you're Creighton, you can do two things. You can look at the micro where Greg McDermott gave a foul with 6 seconds left, which allowed them 2 extra seconds to run their offense, which ended up looming large. And they were 0-for-10 from three in the second half. They had plenty of chances to win that basketball game. And they quite frankly just didn't come through. Was it good defense or just bad shooting? I think it was a little bit of both. I don't think San Diego State had, like, you know, Brad Stevens level closeouts where you're touching the guy's nose on every three. I mean, they had some good open looks and they missed them. They missed them all half. They had big offensive droughts. Credit San Diego State. They're a great defensive team, but Creighton had plenty of opportunities and didn't come through. To put the entire game on that call just is, I think, a negligent take.
Right. No question. The one thing about, and you bring it up because San Diego State played unbelievable three-point defense at Louisville, heels to the three-point line, trying to make you take tough twos, something that is not in Alabama's philosophy, for instance. But Alabama in the regional semifinal shot very poorly from three as well. And I think one thing that happens is when you play the type of physical defense that San Diego State does, is that occasionally when you get open looks, you don't think you're as open, or that you have to hurry, or you're a little off rhythm, a little out of sync. It's not quite in the flow that you would normally get the shot, because I haven't seen the numbers yet, the metrics on what Creighton did with open looks, but Alabama shot like 20% on what was deemed open looks from three. And, you know, that's, you're not going to win many games against a team of that caliber, a defensive team of that caliber, if you don't make the open shots that you get. And Creighton wasn't able to do that yesterday, but still plenty of opportunities in a 1-point game. I understand the philosophy behind when fans say, I don't want the officials to decide the game.
Nobody does.
But the officials have to decide it, because if not, they are deciding it by virtue of the fact that they don't make the call, because the rules are in place. Both teams have to abide by them. And, you know, was it an egregious foul? Was it a large amount of contact? No, but I kind of go back to that whole thing about protecting the shooter. There are so many more great stories in there. There was a flip side to it, and you and I talked before the podcast about whether you wanted to tell this story or not, but you encountered a kind of a terrible and unseemly incident in the aftermath of that game involving the official who made the call, Lee Castle.
Yeah, so I was flying out that night.
So we had the afternoon game, so I tried to get home that night. I had 8 o'clock flight out of Louisville, and I was sitting there minding my own business. And I actually sat down in the same airport row at the gate of my flight to Atlanta to get back to Boston as Lee Castle. And I had no idea it was him. Now, mind you, he made the call 10 feet in front of me, but it didn't register. It was this guy in a Yankees hat. And a Lululemon shirt that just looked like a guy, guy ready to go home. And I was trying to get my phone calls done, calling back home to Kate and Teddy, and just doing normal things. And some Creighton fans recognized him. And it was honestly, Reese, like, really ugly, and it was really pathetic. One guy actually, it was a guy in a plaid shirt who wasn't sitting far from me either, actually followed him into the bathroom to yell at him, and then yelled at him again. He's saying things like, oh, how much money did you have on the game? It's not fair to those kids. And it was almost like they didn't recognize that I was like a human, like it was just one of the most completely unself-aware things I've ever seen. The guy had two boys with him who I assume were his sons and his wife. And like, I was just like, how do you act that way? Like, what kind of life lessons are you showing there? Now, Lee, to his credit, and I ended up sitting not far from him and chatting with him a little bit and trying to help him, quite frankly, because it was just an unseemly scene. Really, like, kept his cool and really didn't react, because that has to be really hard in like just a wide open situation like that. And you've got literally he had nowhere to go. And mm-hmm. So I credit his composure, just to sort of endure that and not snap back and not react. But the guy was just a true pure jerk, very, really proud of himself for all the stuff he said and kept going on and on. I just kept thinking, like, what kind of example are you setting for your kids, dude? Like, it was a really good reminder. I chatted with Lee a little bit about it on the flight. Dude, he just said the stuff you hear parents say in front of their kids in the stands. It's almost like that, the ticket gives you a right to just harass another human. So it was really unfortunate. And I bring it up mostly in part to just like remind people and listeners, like, man, these guys are people. And, guy was going back to see his kids and, just trying to get on a flight out of town and did his job. And I thought really made the right call. And I told him it in a tough situation.
It's the passion of the fans that borders on irrational is one of the things that make sports and particularly college sports great. But when you run over that line, and there is a line mm-hmm. of decorum that you really shouldn't run over. Now, you want to yell at the other team within bounds of at least decent taste. You want to yell at the officials during the game from the stands within the bounds of decent taste and hopefully without a lot of bad language, without a lot of vulgarity. You want to do that. If that's fun to you, I don't really know why that's fun. Maybe that was fun to me when I was a college freshman or something, but I don't get it now as an adult. You want to do it during the game within the bounds of some decorum. Go ahead. I think it's weird, but go ahead. I'd rather just see you cheer for your team. But once it's over, I think the thing that fans find so hard to grasp, some, not all, I'm painting with too broad a brush. Fans like the ones you encountered have a hard time understanding that officials, broadcasters, reporters, that they are there to cover the game or to officiate the game, and they have respect for both sides, and they don't care who wins. They don't have money on or against your team. Probably somebody's going to dig up some historical clip of some referee that did. I get that. But by and large, people understand what we're talking about here. They're just trying to do the game. They're just trying to call the game. I mean, what a professional job, for instance, by Jim Nantz, who had the moment with Houston, which was really cool when Kelvin Sampson called him up and they broke down with Hello Friends, which was great. And then he sees, look, I'm sure deep in Jim's soul someplace, he would have thought it'd been really cool to call his last Final Four in Houston with his alma mater winning the national championship.
Sure.
And then when they didn't, guy called a game like a pro. Yeah. You never would have known and that's how officials, by and large, officiate games. Do they make mistakes? Of course they do. So do broadcasters, coaches, players, and obviously fans. But do they do it maliciously? Almost never. Almost never. Now, do they call attention to themselves sometimes? Do they do things, because they get angry and make mistakes that way? Of course they do. They do. But they're not trying to hose your team. And,
Teddy Valentine butt slap. Did you see that from the NIT on Twitter?
No, I didn't.
It was a SoCon coach. I don't remember. It was smart. Teddy gave him like a little too aggressive of a little tap. It wasn't a tap. It was more like a slap. And the coach's face went like viral. It was like, oh, what?
I don't know if you saw it at the ACC tournament. Teddy was calling one of the games and he snuck up behind Greenberg and he started acting like he was shining his head. And I got it put out on Twitter.
I did see that.
For people who don't know Ted Valentine, I mean, is he theatrical? Is he animated? Yes. Has he made errors? Of course. Joel Berry certainly has. But he's a good dude, man. I mean, Teddy, and
he's
you know
a
what?
Good ref too.
And I was going to say, you ask coaches about it. They say, I know. Yeah, sometimes they'll take him every time in a big game because he gets the call right. I mean, Greenberg even says sometimes you would go back when he was coaching and you'd be so angry at Teddy after a game and you'd go back and review the tape and go, oh, crap, he got it right. It was sort of infuriating at times. Yeah. But going back to the main point, you got to leave that stuff in the arena and you don't need to be vulgar and you certainly don't need to accost someone in a public place outside the arena of competition. It's ridiculous. But most Creighton fans are great.
Great fan base. Awesome. Passionate fan base.
One or two knuckleheads.
And I wasn't casting them all on this guy. The person who handled it best was Greg McDermott. So I asked the question in the press conference. It was what everyone's going to talk about and write about from the game. So I asked him about the foul call. And I asked him if it was in line with the way he felt the game was called. And then there was that sort of ambiguous situation at the end with the 90-foot pass that somehow it took 1.2 seconds for the ball to get tipped and then go out of bounds. That they never gave a direction of where it would go. And they just kind of ended the game. So anyway, there was just a lot of lingering stuff in the last 30 seconds. And it was what people want to know. Greg McDermott basically said, we're going to win with class and lose with class. And the officials didn't cost us this game. Bottom line, I'm paraphrasing here, but he just in the moment, given the chance. And I don't think that was really how he felt. I think the way he felt was pretty clear. And you can, do a little lip reading on the sideline. It was pretty obvious. Pretty obvious how he felt, but he absolutely led the high road, took the highest of high roads in that situation, which is not as the case. So tip of the cap to him. It would have helped my story probably if he was a little bit spicier.
San Diego State gets Florida Atlantic. The Owls of Dusty May, the former Bob Knight manager, led the Owls into the Final Four, which is a remarkable thing. UConn plays Miami. Miami coming back seemingly out of it against Texas and making it in. Before we get to Texas hiring Rodney Terry on a full-time basis, those matchups, Pete, people always say, I want new blood. I want new teams. I like the randomness. Want to see a bunch of new teams. And I saw someone tweet today, and I think it's a really good point. If you're not a television executive, why in the world would you care what the ratings are? And,
yeah,
you know,
I agree with that.
I don't know that it's reflective of the health of the sport. I suspect that this will be a low rated Final Four, but what if they're good games? What if the drama is great?
People watch the Final Four.
Those of us who like college basketball, love college basketball. Yeah. You're going to watch the games. You're going to enjoy the drama. That said, the one thing that this Final Four will not have that we've had other times and that we had last year, certainly, is anticipation for anyone outside the fan base and building of drama. You're not always going to get Coach K's last ride against his arch rival. I get it. But when you do get Carolina Duke, or those years when you got a Memphis going in undefeated, or Kentucky going in 2015 undefeated with all those great teams, maybe some legend, 03, Boeheim trying to get a national championship finally. When you have some type of storyline to build up during the week, it makes the event seem even bigger. You're not getting that. And you're not getting that with either of these matchups. Are there great storylines? You bet. San Diego State, Dutcher, longtime assistant, Final Four, amazing story. Florida Atlantic on its face. I mean, Dusty May's gym in Boca is barely bigger than his high school gym he played in Indiana, right? I mean, this is amazing. Miami didn't have a program for like 15 years. Not that well. It's been a while ago now, but like 40 years ago, they shut down the program. Wasn't important, you know. And I had a guy, and I'm going to say this on game day Saturday. I had a guy who would know, who said that they used to announce attendance after they reinstituted the program in the first few years. They would announce attendance basically by going, hey, what are the last four digits of your phone number? And they just made it up because there was nobody there. And I almost made a grave error and told you what the last four digits of my phone number are, but that wouldn't be good. That wouldn't be good attendance. So I'm really glad I didn't do that. But Miami in the Final Four after consecutive Elite Eights, and regardless of what happens, Jim Boeheim, in my mind, Jim Larrañaga, with his accomplishments.
They're both very tall.
They're both tall. They're both balding. They're both elderly.
One's a little kinder.
Sometimes one's a little less grouchy. I would say that's probably fair. But, you know, I think he's going to, you know, at some point go into the Hall of Fame because
he should.
George Mason in Miami. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Not to mention putting together all of this and the strife they had surrounding NIL with Nigel Pack coming in at the beginning of the season.
It's not strife, Reese. That's like being ahead of the curve. I don't know why anyone could
No. You misunderstand. When Isaiah Wong's rep said, hey, you got to up the ante here or we're out of here.
Yes.
I'm talking about that.
Fair. Yep. No, that's
what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the other. So you know that's bubbling. That bubbles everywhere. Yeah. And it's human nature. I mean, people in our business, hey, I can't believe this guy's making X. Well, his contract came up at a different time. So it goes.
Yeah.
And but this is a new frontier for college coaches, and he managed that beautifully. And then you have UConn. You know, I'd forgotten they were unranked in the preseason because they zoomed so high so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so obvious when you watched them play early in the season with all of the talent, this Final Four caliber team. So you've got a juggernaut historically against three upstarts, but you're not going to have that anticipation leading up to it. That doesn't mean there can't be great games or memorable championship game, but you're not getting, we're awaiting Wisconsin, Kentucky, we're awaiting a potential Duke Kentucky match.
Yeah.
You know, you're not getting that. And so we'll just have to wait for Saturday.
So this is the difference to me. It's star power.
And this is, I think, a little bit of what college basketball on the floor, what college basketball has probably been lacking for the last handful of years. And I really think it manifests itself this weekend. Now, I'm not saying that the games aren't good and the matchups aren't good, and the players aren't good, but is there a singular player in this Final Four where you are like, wow, I can't wait to see that guy play basketball? And I'm also like, because I live in a pro town, so a lot of my friends watch the NCAA tournament through this prism. I can't wait to see that guy get drafted and become a, you know, is he going to be a Sixer? Is he going to be a Celtic? Is he going to be a Knick? Whatever it is. Like, there are no McDonald's All-Americans. Jeff Borzello tweeted that out the other day. I thought that was an unbelievable stat. Like, wow. And I'd have to dig in a little bit more, but I would be pretty surprised if there was a first round pick out of these four teams. Am I right about that?
Probably. I mean, Sanogo is dominant, but I mean, they list him at only 6'9". Klingon may eventually be a first round pick.
Of the big guy. I mean, this year, I think, is probably the fairest thing.
I don't know. I would, maybe Jordan Hawkins, if he comes out just because he can really shoot it, but you know, he'd probably be toward the end of it. So I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
And if you just notice, all of the guys I mentioned are all playing at Connecticut, and none of them were, none of them were.
Now, look, Miller was unbelievable for Miami this weekend. I mean, you can't argue that he's a terrific player.
Man.
Yes, he's a great player. And this isn't a criticism, and this isn't, I'm not trying to give people reasons not to watch. It's just an evolution. It's where college basketball has gone. You know, people are scattering and they're going to different places, and it's great, right? Like this is, I think, a really interesting experiment to how the paradigms of the game have changed and where people end up. I mean, what is it? A four, two fives, and a nine.
And a nine. It's the second highest.
Especially seed like that total. Nine, by the way. We can get to that.
Yeah,
later.
I know. That's right. It's the second highest seed total. And the other thing, too, is you look at all of these teams, with the exception of UConn, who has destroyed everybody in their path.
Yes.
Every other team in the Final Four could have or should have lost. Fort Atlantic was down without the ball in the first round with 5 seconds left in the game or something against Memphis and somehow won the game. San Diego State, you know, not only did they trail by nine to Alabama in the second half, but they were tied or down, I think, to Charleston early. Miami trailed Drake in the first round fairly late in the game. And then obviously Miami yesterday against down Texas 13. was down and almost out, it seemed. So it takes a little bit of luck to get through. But the one thing that you notice about all of those teams that came back, they didn't panic. They're all old. I mean, there is a dearth of high level impact freshmen that have gotten into this Final Four. You know, typically the last few years, you've had older teams win it, but you've always seemed to have had someone who was younger on that who were playing huge roles. All these guys are old. And part of it is the NIL stuff. They can stick around. They can make a little more money. Some guys aren't as suited for the modern NBA game as they are for the college game.
Yes.
And they do better in college. And what's another year? You know,
how about Armando Bacot coming back?
Well, right. Exactly. He's a perfect example. He and Oscar Tshiebwe are perfect examples of guys who, the way the NBA game is right now, they're not big enough to play that way. I mentioned Klingon earlier. He's so stinking big that, you know, that he can get up there and block some shots and, you know, and he can run the floor and finish because of his size. He's probably a little different. But if you're 6'9", you know, it's a little harder if you don't have some range on your shot, or if you don't have some explosiveness in your, you know, in your game in terms of leaping or something.
You know, I would need Klingon to make the league and be a top 10 pick.
Why?
Because he has to elbow out of the way the most famous Bristol Central graduate that works in the NBA right now.
Well, it's got to be Woj, right?
It's Woj. It's Woj. You got to get Woj out of there. He needs to elbow Adrian Woj right out of there. Hey, he needs to get some of that Bristol Central shine going.
You and Woj do a little tag team on breaking the Pitino story?
We did, yeah. Worked with Woj. It was a lot of fun. He's very laid back, you know, if you've ever been around him.
Not intense at all. Well, people know this. I'm not breaking news here, but when I hosted the NBA draft, and I did it for about 10 years, when Woj came over, it transformed our draft coverage. Transformed it. I remember on a couple of occasions riding with him to the draft and having, you know, front office people or scouts or coaches, you know, sometimes guys who were going to make the decision that night, calling him and you know, running things by him and bouncing it off of him and stuff like that, or potential deals or whatever. And, you know, it's an amazing thing to watch guys like you work who have put in all that time to establish those connections. And then with Woj, with the connections in the NBA, it's fascinating, which, by the way, his alma mater has company now, at least in the three newcomers into the Final Four. The last one, I think it was 1970 in St. Bonaventure. St. Bonaventure was entered along with, can you name the other, obviously UCLA because they won it. You know the other two?
So one of them was Jacksonville.
That's right. Duval.
Yeah. Hometown. Yeah. Artis Gilmore. Yeah, there you go. There you go. From Artis to Trevor. And I don't remember the other one. I was also not alive. So I don't really feel like.
I don't remember this Final Four because I guess I was four. But New Mexico State.
Oh, that's right.
How about that? You know what I get mixed up is because 2 years later, Florida State made the Final Four with Hugh Durham as the head coach. But for some reason in my mind, I want Hugh Durham to have been coaching at Jacksonville and coaching Artis Gilmore at that time.
Sure.
It's one of those things that you know, but in your mind, it gets juxtaposed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
So who do you like, Reese?
UConn.
Yeah.
I mean, I had UConn going to the championship game, losing to Alabama. But and as the tournament unfolded, if I'd had a do-over on that, I would have probably picked UConn to win that game. Almost did anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I know they had that stretch midseason where they lost 6 out of 8. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just from the first few times I saw them play in December, I was like, yeah, those dudes can go. And you know,
so I picked just, Iona.
Wait, so we all had those.
Yeah. I had all four of my Final Four
out by the Sweet 16. Teddy Thamel, who's 13 months old, was leading the family bracket at last check. He had the Zags, and for a minute I was like, this little sucker might win the pool we're in.
Yeah, he's going to do good. You know, I had the other thing too, and I had long since given up rooting for my bracket, but After all of the carnage in it, I almost had two of the Final Four because I had Texas.
Yeah.
And then you could have won the darn thing.
I had
Miami out in the first round. I had them, which they almost did.
Yeah.
Almost lost to Drake. But
did you see that the 9.5 quintillion stat? Like there's more sand. You have a better chance of
More sand.
Yeah, there's more grains of sand. Like literally, I thought about that like three times. Because it's just so random, like just trying to pick this thing. And it's actually freeing when your bracket just gets destroyed. You could just sort of watch unencumbered by it. Like,
which this brings me to this, because we were texting a little bit among our pod group with Sarah and Taylor during the tournament. This inevitably happens to me when you're not rooting for the bracket, especially if a team is coming back. As I was watching this weekend, I found myself hoping Florida Atlantic would finish this off. And sure. immediately after they did, I felt remorse for hoping it would happen, because I loved the Kansas State story. Marquise Noel was just, he was like going on a Kemba-like run. I was sad it was over, and I felt awful for them. Same thing with Miami and Texas. And this was not because I picked Texas to go to the Final Four or anything about it, but as Miami was coming back, I found myself saying, this would be cool, because first of all, I've done some Miami games over the last few years, and all of those guys, great guys to be around, a great program to be around, a great dynamic young rising star on the staff, Cody Kimball, who's going to be a great head coach someday, and just great guys to be around. So I find myself caught up and come on, let's finish this thing. And as soon as they do it, I feel devastated for Texas.
Well, for Rodney Terry,
and for him, and Marcus Carr was so good, sure. And Timmy Allen, Sir Jabari Rice, so many terrific players on the team, and you feel devastated for them. And I've come to the conclusion that if you're not working the games in the moment where you have, if you don't do this for a living, I find it hard to be able to explain it completely. There's a little switch that when you're working that kind of takes the emotion out of it for you. Mm-hmm. But if you're sitting on your couch, just like a fan, and if I weren't a fan, I wouldn't do this for a living. As I'm sitting on the couch, the emotions go back and forth. And I've come to the conclusion that the tournament only makes you miserable unless your team wins or you win the pool. otherwise it's going to find a way to make you miserable, because you're going to see the devastation from the Texas players, and your heart's going to go out to them. You're going to see, Marquise Noel and his brother, who obviously was just in the garden on Sunday. And, but you would have felt the same way if it had gone the other way. You felt badly for Miami or FAU.
Yeah, it's why I'm grateful, especially in college football. Like, I don't gamble. I can't gamble. It just wouldn't be part of what it. But like that just tortures your enjoyment of the game. Like, I love a college football game. It could be Louisiana Tech Rice. I love college football. I'm gonna watch it. Same thing with the tournament. I'm gonna watch the heck out of every tournament game. And when you have something that is impacting your joy of the game, obviously we're both huge fans of both sports, right? We consume massive amounts of it and enjoy it. When you have something that can impact just the pure joy of it, because there's an angle there, it does. It's just like you start yelling at the TV, you start, it's not the same. I understand why people gamble, because there's that rush there. You know what I mean? It's a huge part of the sports. I'm not discounting that, but when I have that, or even when we have our dumb like race for the case thing, and I want somebody, I want somebody to win a race for the, race for the ribeye, I'm rooting against you and Bill Connolly. It impacts the game. And so I just rather have it like play out with no emotion.
Yeah. But the emotion part of it makes it fun. Do you believe in, I thought this out a little bit because of Kansas State's loss in the Elite Eight, and very few people would know the history of Alabama's tournament woes, as I would, having gone to school there. Do you believe in tournament DNA? Like, it can carry over. I mean, the hardcore basketball people will tell you, this stuff doesn't matter. It never matters. It's different team, different era, different time.
It's a good question. It's a little bit like living in Boston. Like, can the Red Sox be cursed if it's different managers, right, and different pitchers and different players? Right. And I think I believed it to an extent. Like, stylistically, Rick Barnes has a tournament problem, right? Stylistically, Nate Oates is starting to show he could have a tournament problem because of sort of the feast famine way they play. So I think via coach, but via program, if you're going back to Wimp Sanderson, then I don't believe in tournament DNA.
Well, okay,
I do
well, think let me, Let me explain my theory to you, which is a little nebulous and certainly not altogether scientific. Kansas State gets to the Elite Eight.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these times they lost to Danny and the Miracles in the Elite Eight. They lost to Butler. They lost to Loyola Chicago. And they lost to FAU. Okay, now that's a trend. And when I put that out on Twitter, one Power Cat Emaw fan pointed out there was also one in the 70s, apparently, that I didn't recall. Alabama now is 1-9 in Sweet 16 games. And you say, well, so what? Alabama's no good at basketball. You know what? Only one team has won more tournament games than Alabama without a Final Four appearance. Only Xavier.
Wow. Okay.
Xavier also has a little bit of that. Now, okay, mostly it's coincidence. I get that. But I also think that a couple of things happen. I think that there's a psychology involved. Not that the players even think about this, but what you expect. It's sort of like when you play against either for or against Duke or Kentucky in basketball, North Carolina or UConn or whatever. There's an expectation to win. And maybe if things aren't going your way, then the pressure comes after you and the other side's a lot looser. If you're in an Alabama or Kansas State situation where your success, historically speaking, over a wide, long period of time has been sporadic, then maybe that pressure comes at you in a different way when you get on that stage and you don't play your best. And you know, it's an interesting thing because I'll bet you that the majority, and I would be interested to see when we post these clips, I'll bet you a lot of the star-crossed teams in the tournament over the years, Tennessee's a good one, even pre-Barnes, I'll bet they can recite chapter and verse of games that got away, games that they should have won, they couldn't, it got tight, they couldn't finish it. And I think the be-all, end-all nature of the tournament now really lends itself to this psychology of guys pressing. And the antidote to that is to have a dude who can overcome it on his own, to have Kemba Walker, to have potentially almost Marquise Noel. And it was what Brandon Miller was called on to do and could not do. So I think there's something to it psychologically, just because of human nature, of what you expect, what you're surrounded by every day, what the expectations are in terms of winning. You know, do you rush the floor if you're Kansas State after you beat Kansas? And then Jerome Tang says, let's not do that anymore. Let's expect to win. Well, you rush the floor out there. You probably really didn't expect it at first. So I think there's a little bit of unprovable psychology to it, but somehow it keeps rearing its head for the same teams over and over. And, you know, Xavier went out around early, but you remember, I think probably when Miller was there the first time, they had a little problem getting past the Elite Eight. And it's not just one or two programs. There are several that have their issues.
He had the same problem at Arizona in the Elite Eight too.
Fair enough.
I do think that there's a, when you play at a blue blood, when you play at a place where winning is an expectation, that changes your approach. You have to be wired a little bit differently. You operate a little bit differently. Standards are a little bit different when you play at a place like that. Whereas if you play at a place where you're chasing everything, you know, things that are new, I think it does. I think it does alter that. I just don't know. I will buy your theory. Like, I'll buy it half. I don't know if I buy it Wimp Sanderson back. You know what I mean?
No, it's not debilitating. It doesn't mean you can't ever do it.
Sure.
I think it just means there's something there that you have to overcome.
It's an extra obstacle. That's fair.
Yeah. It's an extra obstacle psychologically that can rear its head in a number of ways. You know, it can either, you know, it can make you play poorly, but I also think it works against the favorites every now and then. And obviously it varies person to person, but you have those types of expectations and you're Duke, and all of a sudden the game gets tight late and you lose to Lehigh, or, you know, Virginia's the number one seed. They're still chasing it that time. It gets tight late. Oh gosh, we can't be the first one to lose to a 16. And then all of a sudden you lose by 18 points, you know? And so It depends on the guys. I understand that, and that makes everything different. But I do think it gets in there somehow on a subliminal or subconscious level.
Who knew this would be the basketball psychology podcast?
I love all this stuff because, you know, I said this on the podcast, I think the last time we were there, it goes back, and really probably the best way to frame this is there's no provable way to say that your record in the tournament impacts your performance. I mean, I'm not saying that. I'm saying it. The coincidence keeps coming up. So why?
Yeah.
And it really probably comes down to this, the old Bob Knight, since one of his former managers is in the Final Four. The mental is to the physical is 4-1. Yeah. And, you know, there are only so many new plays. Although I did like the fact that I did like seeing Kansas State run mesh football patterns.
That's been one of the great developments.
Because there's a couple other teams that ran it early. There's a high school coach. I want to say it's like Caleb Williams' OC from Gonzaga.
Yeah.
In D.C. has put all of the basketball inbound football plays on Twitter, and they're on bubble screens.
Yeah. Well, I saw that. I've forgotten who did that now, but I saw maybe FAU ran a bubble screen to get a ball in bounds. But that also is something else as I've complained a little bit about the officiating here. Have you noticed that we are taking football and making it people to talk about basketball and grass and creating space and making rules for the offense? We've taken football and made it more like basketball in some aspects, obviously. Yeah. And obviously we've taken basketball and we're letting them play like it's football sometimes. Yes. So maybe somebody's going to have the bright idea to start a new hybrid sport where they're like eight guys on a 50-yard field.
Helmets or no helmets?
No helmets.
Okay.
No. Okay. The soft light wrestling helmets or you know,
like the spring practice, like before you get in full pad,
those things that like they wear at the opening or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. 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 No, I know exactly.
Those
what you're
things.
Talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Those things. They could probably wear those.
That's good. Yeah. I do generally agree with you on that. Like, I wonder if this San Diego State, you know, is this a little bit now, again, the other teams are pretty free flowing. I mean, Miami's fun to watch. They're well coached on offense. Here's a general observation I have that ties along to that. How many teams did you watch in this tournament that were just like dreadfully stagnant on offense? Like just like, you know, it's like 4 minutes to go and it's a big possession. And there's like one guy dribbling, four guys sitting. Maybe somebody goes and like sets a half-hearted screen. It just doesn't seem like college basketball offense. Again, the players aren't as skilled. They're not as good. Has near the intricacies and symmetry and intentionality of NBA offense.
It's I know everything's different now, but every now and then when you bring something like that up, it reminds me when I was in high school 100 years ago, our coach believed in doing everything, you know, in the Bob Knight Indiana philosophy. So we ran motion poorly, but we ran it. But it was a cardinal sin to screen the ball. You just never screen the ball. And I know that even the steadfast motion advocates later on, you know, adapted and employed ball screens, but it was always screen away, down screen or screen away. You didn't screen the ball. And now nobody does anything except screen the ball. It seems like, you know, maybe a little action.
That is the offense.
On the side, but that is the offense now. So, but yeah, it happens. But that's why, like, Creighton runs good offense. Miami's fun to watch. UConn gets out and goes, you know, Fort Atlantic will try. But, you know, the first semifinal is going to be low scoring because that's what San Diego State does. Second one's going to be better. Best game of the tournament. So before we get out of here, this is easy for me. This is easy. Best game of the tournament.
You go. I'm going to think about it for a second.
Kansas State and Michigan State.
Yeah. So I was writing a story during that game and didn't like, I like ducked in late on it. It has the Garden and Noel, what do you have? 19 assists.
Yeah, 20 points, 19 assists. And Michigan State hit so many big shots. They, you know, and they both teams up and down and scoring. And it's not like they were doing the old Loyola Marymount thing and letting you score to get the ball back, you know, which I'm no fan of. But, you know, it's, you know, they were guarding, but they were making shots. That was the best game of the tournament up to this point to me. It was great.
So the game, if you could judge the tournament game by the volume of visceral reaction that I had during the most intense moments, I would say that I would probably have to go with Furman, Virginia.
Yeah.
Just the way that game ended. I was on the Peloton watching, just because it was like a long afternoon. I was getting workout in, and I absolutely howled like when that shot went in.
It was amazing.
You see the pass, you're like, and then it's like, that was a blast.
I'll tell you one other, I'll fess up. One of those things, again, I didn't care who won the game, but when Julian Strother took the shot that won the game for Gonzaga against UCLA, when he pulled up, I said out loud, just my wife and I were sitting watching him, I said, "What are you doing?"
And he made the shot. You're glad you weren't on the call.
I know. I'd like to think I would have had a little more discipline if I'd been on the call there. But I said that. I said, "What are you doing? Oh, what a shot!"
Yeah. So I was at a. This would surprise people, but I was at a bar in Louisville for that game. After dinner, we went to Jack Ruby's for dinner, and then the bar was closing down, so we went and. Some little bourbon
bait. I hope you went to Jeff Ruby's.
I did go to Jeff Ruby's.
Instead of Jack Ruby's.
I said Jack Ruby's. I went there twice. You'd think I'd remember.
No, Jack Ruby.
The Jeff Ruby's. Sorry, it's great
Jack
there.
Ruby, Jack Ruby apparently had some establishments back in the day. Anyway, I digress and go into historical context. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I butchered the name. And so like the shot goes up and you just hear everybody in the bar. You know, it was a ton of Princeton fans actually were in town for that night. And they had kind of taken over part of this bar. And I was with a couple other scribes having a late night beverage. And there was that was a fun moment. That was a really, really fun moment. I mean, feet on the logo.
Yeah.
It was a great game too, Reese.
It was a great game. That would be another great game. It was a lot of fun.
That would probably end up as the if somebody does one of those lists of ranking the tournament games, like John Gassaway would do it for us. He does a great job. Like that you'd be hard pressed to not have that in the top three.
Okay. Last thing before we let people go. Rodney Terry, Texas. To me, I understand the concept, as someone said earlier in the season, the unfortunate incident involving Chris Beard, had that not happened and he had just chosen, let's say, to go to the NBA, would Rodney Terry have been a candidate? The answer is no. But as it turned out, you could make that you could make the argument that Rodney Terry got an opportunity to show what he could do in a Texas situation and showed that he could excel. And it wasn't a short run. It wasn't like, Steve Fisher proved to be a wonderful coach, both at Michigan and San Diego State, but it wasn't like an emotion fueled short run like Michigan had in 1989. And this was over a long haul. They bounced back from some things. They dealt with some injuries, and I thought he proved worthy of the job. And I think it was a great decision to give him the full-time job. Your thoughts?
I'll be curious how convicted they are contractually
to Rodney Terry. Those details haven't come out yet. I think they're paying him $3 million a year. But where the buyout is and how real the five-year deal is, that to me will show how much Chris Del Conte really wants Rodney Terry there. And is this just okay, you did it, nice job, we'll give you a tryout, or we want you to go and really lock in long-term and succeed? And I think we've seen both in different succession scenarios, over the past couple of years. And yes, there was just no way Texas could not hire Rodney Terry. And look, he was pedestrian in his 9-10 years as a head coach at Fresno and at UTEP. But I look at it as he learned a lot as a head coach. He did not have the type of destination, the type of talent, the type of league platform. And he has a lot of institutional experience at Texas from all those years being under Rick Barnes as an assistant there. So I think Rodney Terry, if they can keep some of the staff, which is all former head coaches, is really going to be set up to succeed and thrive and push forward there. And I mean, Chris Beard made Texas a high-end recruiting destination in the state and beyond. And now Shaka Smart recruited really well there. I mean, when you look at the players through there, you'd be like, wow. And so can Rodney Terry keep that momentum going? I think we'll learn a lot here in the next couple of months, because they need guys that the same caliber of player committing to Rodney Terry's Texas.
That's a fair point. One thing I would say, maybe not in terms of salary, because I understand maybe you have a guy prove himself and develop that over a period of time. But if you go in, and I'm not suggesting Chris Del Conte did this, but if an athletic director goes in and hires any coach, again, let's see how this works out, then you shouldn't hire him. Have the guts to step up and not hire him. If you're hiring a guy, support him 100% and see how it goes. And, you know, you probably, if it works out the way you want it to, then maybe you'll get to give him a bunch more money and everybody will be happy.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't go in with, you know, one eye on your list. You know, you've got he has to have a list. You have to, because Texas thought it didn't need a list until, you know, this season. You got to have your list. But if you go in with a new coach with one eye on your list, then you're helping him fail. So don't do that. You know, I'm assuming that they should be behind him. I hope they are. And I'm very happy for him. I hope he does well.
Yes. So I think we need to end on this note.
What Houston Steakhouse do our listeners think Reese Davis should take me to on Sunday? I think we need some social media recommendations, and we're open to all. I've been to Houston a bunch of times. I wouldn't say I know it that well. So, open to all recommendations from our fine listenership.
We will listen. The bet was that one team seeded 7 or lower would make the Final Four, and I sort of openly mocked Pete when he was left with Ford Atlantic and my beloved Princeton Tigers, but. You know, you pulled it out of the fire. So good for you. And I get a steak out of it too, because I'm not going to let you eat a steak and I'm not going to eat one. So that'll be good.
Yeah. Me, Carrot Top, who's
an FAU grad. We learned that today. Tom Herman. We are all owls, Reese. We are all owls.
Hey, if Herman's there, he should go with us. I'll buy his steak too.
All right. Well, if the Owls win, Tom Herman spent a lot of time in Houston. He probably know a good place.
He probably knows a good place. All right, my man. That was fun. Right. Congratulations on getting back home after that long ordeal. Flying back.
5:01 a.m. arrival on Sunday. So nobody wants to hear about our travel, but that was
congratulations. They probably want to hear about that. But that was the other part of it that you told was interesting for sure.
That was interesting.
This has been the College Game Day Podcast. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. We'll be back with you at some point during the weekend, the Final Four. Our good friends Taylor and Sarah, who keep us on track, sort of. On this, we'll make it apparent when we record another podcast. Thanks for listening.